My name is Kate Clancy, and I'm one of the organizers of the CAC. If this is your first time at the CAC panel, you'll find that our programming tends to be a little different from what you'll find in other rooms here at the Convention Center. This is an academic conference that takes place in the heart of Comic-Con, so we have a tendency to go a little bit more in-depth in our discussion of the medium that we're all here to celebrate. We have programs that are dedicated to the CAC on a table in the back. If you want to grab one, it'll outline what we've got going on. We're in this room from 10:30 to 3:30 all weekend long. Also on the back, also there's other flyers and stuff on the table, so you should totally, if you have not skimmed over it, you should on your way out. The back of our programs also have a call for papers, so if you'd like to participate in the CAC in the future, this will tell you where to submit your proposals. We have shirts for sale over at the Comic-Con merch booth over in Marriott. They're brown this year. They have the CAC logo on the front, and on the back, in the Walking Dead theme, the Walking Educators. So you can get those over at the Marriott, and the proceeds for that sale goes to Comic-Con International. This is our second panel of today. Two women and Wonder Woman. We have the inimitable Nikki Wheeler-Nicholson and Trina Robbins here to talk to us about Wonder Woman, and I'm going to turn the microphone over to Nikki.
Thanks. Can everybody hear me okay?
Yeah.
Okay, great. I'm Nikki Wheeler-Nicholson. My grandfather started National Allied Publications in 1934 that eventually became DC Comics. And how many of you read the Jill LaCour book? Okay. Dr. John Lent at Temple University in Philadelphia puts out an incredible journal called the International Journal of Comic Art, Cartoon and Comic Art. And he asked me to look at the LaCour book and give some thoughts on it. So, full disclosure, I'm very close friends with Marston family. I was very close friends with Pete and with his daughter, Christy, whom many of you probably know very well. And so I went to the Marston household, and I said, oh, Dr. Lentz asked me to do this article on Jill LaCour's book. And they both said, okay. And I thought, but I really like Jill LaCour's writing. She's an excellent writer. And I've enjoyed her articles, particularly focused on women's issues in The New Yorker. So I thought, well, I'm a comic book family person, and I know sometimes comic book families can have feelings about things, so I thought, let me give her the benefit of the doubt here. So Christy said to me, yeah, you should read it. And she said, do me a favor, while you're reading it, keep checking back to the notes on each chapter. Well, wow. I was really, really surprised. There are a lot of great things in the book that I enjoy, particularly about the women's suffrage movement. My great-grandmother, the reason we have this ridiculous name, was a suffragette. And in the tradition of suffragettes, she used her father's name and tacked on her husband's name. So she became, instead of Antoinette Wheeler, she became Antoinette Wheeler-Nicholson. So that part of the book I really enjoyed. But there were a lot of things that I did not enjoy and that I felt Jill LaCour really fell down academically. There were a lot of contradictions in the book and in the notes. The notes that pertained to things in the book didn't make any sense half the time. It was really, really strange. And then the other thing that I had a hard time with is that this is an unusual family. And it's very easy to go off on the family dynamics. And she did. And I didn't think that was really such a great thing to do. And on top of that, when you have been a child of an unusual creative person, sometimes the family things that get passed on. And particularly for this family, which had an unusual configuration, they're bound to have been feelings that got passed on. And by only taking one particular person's view of the thing when there were four other children, I think that was a mistake. And I think it just was not a good balance all the way around. I have a master's in the divine feminine in classical Greek mythology and theater. So Wonder Woman for me is all about the Greek myths. And this is the other place that I felt Lepore really fell down. And I was surprised because she's an academic. And her big focus in the book is that she feels that Margaret Sanger is one of the really big and major influences for Wonder Woman. And there are some aspects to that, but she just ignored the whole Greek mythology aspect of it. So let's see what William Moulton Marston himself said about Wonder Woman.
Said this way, right?
I'm sorry, I'm technologically challenged.
Okay.
So this was the first
appearance of Wonder Woman in All-Star Comics number 8.
And in it, there is an origin story. And it is completely about the Greek myths. This is the more enlarged story from Wonder Woman number 1. If you haven't seen this in a reprint, I encourage you to see it because it's really terrific. And it goes through the whole origin of how Wonder Woman came to be. And it the whole myth of Aphrodite and Hercules and the whole aspect of war. How many of you know much about the Greek myths? Oh, yay! Okay. So I'm assuming that you all know the wonderful myth of Aphrodite, who was supposedly married to Hephaestus, and she and Ares, Mars, had a little thing going on, and he decided that he would catch the two of them when they were having their thing. So he fashioned a net, and he hung the net over the bed, and when they were going at it, the net dropped. So what's interesting about this comic book origin of Wonder Woman is the lasso.
And
she talks about it being forged from the net of Aphrodite. So if you want to see that direct connection between Wonder Woman and the lasso and Aphrodite's net, for those of you who are interested in the pre-patriarchal versions of the myth, Aphrodite was sea foam and seaborne, and the net is hers. It didn't fall down on her, some guy doing it to her. It's her net. So this makes much more sense. And when you think about William Marston, who was, I guess we could call him a feminist, and certainly his wife, Elizabeth Holloway, who was both of them were Greek scholars. And so it's not surprising Wonder Woman's lasso would be directly connected to Aphrodite's net. One of the things that Lepore mentioned in the book had to do with some of the sexual aspects of the Marston's life. And she used this from one of the stories
It's
The Mystery of the Crimson Flame. And in the comic, Wonder Woman comes in and she dissolves the cult, but unfortunately, Lepore used it as a means of making it seem like this was part of the whole Wonder Woman aspect. I'm just going to say, how am I doing?
Oh, you've got about 11 minutes.
Okay. The other thing that's also important to recognize about the Amazons, is that the mythology of the Amazon is really fascinating. And there were some women who were in the academic field during the time that Marston and Elizabeth Holloway were at Harvard. And they were writing books about the myths of the Amazons. And this was also something that I thought Lepore kind of missed, because she's a very strong feminist, and it seemed to me that that was a missed opportunity to actually talk about women who were, if you think about this period, it's like, what, 1911, 12? These people are doing this. These women are out in the field as archaeologists, and they're talking and they're writing and talking about these Amazon myths. So I thought that was unfortunate also, that she missed that big opportunity. The other thing that really didn't get a whole lot of, that I think is still missing from a lot of the Wonder Woman story, is Harry Peter, the artist, who was phenomenal. And Trina will probably talk more about him. But this is so iconic, I think. And I think the big thing about the Greek myths and Wonder Woman is that the Greek myths are so archetypal, and we identify with gods and goddesses and the stories and the human failings. And I think that's one of the reasons that Wonder Woman is so has kept that sense of that archetypal energy even now, today. So, I guess, for me, that's part of the interest in Wonder Woman, is that not only is that Greek myth and that archetypal energy, but also just the archetypal nature of her as a woman, and what a strong woman, but also able to communicate well. And I think those are aspects of her that really appeal to all of us, not just women, but men as well. So that's really what I wanted to say about the Greek myths, about the Lepore's book, and what I thought was, you know, I just mentioned one other thing. If you're a biographer, usually, as a biographer, you fall in love with the person whose biography you're writing. Well, Lepore not only didn't fall in love with William Moulton Marston, she trashes him throughout her book. This guy is the creator. And she spends most of the book just really putting him down, putting his all of his accomplishments down. So I thought this too was part one of the things that was very disappointing to me about the book. And I know that some of you were excited about the movie that came out that supposedly was based on the book. And so you might want to kind of take a look at that. The Marston family, Christie in particular, was really unhappy about that.
Terrible.
Yeah. So we'll talk back and forth some. I want Trina to have a chance to talk, because she's so knowledgeable about Wonder Woman, and we'll answer questions later. Thanks.
Thank you.
appreciated our return to Peter and that really terrible movie that came out. But that's going to be after my presentation. Okay, the smokescreen shatter of bondage and polyamorism has obscured some very important political messages in William Moulton Marston's Wonder Woman poems. The creator was a left-leaning liberal. As the ultra-feminist he is known to be, this should come as no surprise, yet nobody seems to have noticed this factor in what Donna.
This is forward?
Yep.
Okay, in the July 7th issue of Sensation Comics, this is 1943, I think I didn't write that down, Diana Prince deals with price fixing. She runs into a weeping woman leading a thin little girl. The woman's son has died of malnutrition. He could have been saved. The doctor said Danny was undernourished and couldn't buy milk for him when the price went up. Her little girl has not had any milk for weeks. Poor people just can't afford to pay for milk now. Oh, that's when she talks about the price going up. Okay, Diana goes to the grocery store and discovers 26 cents a quart? That's outrageous! Now, that's going to be very funny to us, but, you know, prices were different in those days. The grocer answers, "We can't help it, lady. The International Milk Company controls the entire supply. They push the price up." Diana forces her way into the office of the milk company's president, Alfonso de Gippo, and confronts him. Oh, and you can see they're pouring out the milk. And he says the milk would feed about 500 kids, but they have to pour it out because, people can't afford to buy it and they're not going to give it away.
The
comes to her senses and announces, "I am not engaged to Prince Delslango. He is a fake, a traitor, and a thief." And she gives him quite a punch there. And she takes over the management of her stores herself, with help as her assistant. "Girls, starting now, your salaries are doubled, your hours and working conditions will be improved. Wonder Woman made me work like you, and now I understand." But even ultra-feminist Marston believed that it would take 1,000 years before a woman could be president. And in view of the 2017 elections, we may have been wrong. The cover of Wonder Woman 7, 1943, is titled "Wonder Woman for President," and a caption at the bottom reads, "Wonder Woman, 1,000 years in the future." The cover depicts Wonder Woman around a crowd of cheering men and women. My first impression upon looking at that cover was that I had seen that picture, that pose, before. And here it is. In 1928, drawn by Nell Brinkley for a series called Dimples Daydreams, in which our flapper heroine imagines running for president only 8 years after women got the vote. It's quite conceivable that Harry G. Peter, who was quite a bit older than his other contemporary cartoonists, could have seen this picture and that it could have stayed in his memory, because he and Nell Brinkley were actually much closer to being contemporaries.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
The story inside the Wonder Woman comic is strangely depressing. In the year 3000, America finally has a woman president, Arda Moore, who wears a slinky evening gown and, like then real-life President FDR, smokes cigarettes in a long holster. Senator He-Man, leader of the Man's World Party, confronts his way into the president's office, forces his way into the office, and confronts her. He demands the release from federal prison of former political leader Grafton Patridge. President Moore responds, "Grafton Patridge? Why, that crook represents all that was bad and corrupt in the political rule of men, which was ended by my election." Heman raves, "You women are feather-brained idealists. You've stopped us men from making money out of public office. You've turned poor people to elect officials who serve the public and expect nothing for themselves." To which President Moore comments, "Quite so." But President Moore refuses the pardon, granted attempts a prison break, which of course Wonder Woman foils. But it's not over. Steve Trevor is duped into running for president on the Man's Party, led by one Professor Manley and his purple shirts. For some reason, President Moore refuses to run against Steve, so Diana Prince runs for president, with Etta Candy at her side as vice president. On election night, the Woman's Party is winning when Manley's purple shirts invade the vote counting rooms, steal the ballots, and substitute fake ballots, which show Steve Trevor winning. Steve finally realizes he's been duped and demands a recount, whereupon Manley attempts to destroy the real ballots. Of course, Wonder Woman wins in the end. Here's Diana Prince taking the oath of office. But does this situation sound vaguely familiar? Back to Dimples and her grand imagination, as drawn by Nell Brinkley. She is elected president. And look at her, a mere 8 years after women got the vote. She's wearing a pantsuit. Thank you.
Thank you.
right, well, we've got plenty of time for questions. Raise your hands and we'll call on you. Don't be shy.
Ladies, as the archetypes change, as each person puts their own mix on it, what direction have you seen the character of Wonder Woman change over time? And do you think that's a good thing, bad thing, just how things change over time?
Her representation has gone up and down through the years. It hasn't just gone, you know, in one direction. It's gone, I don't know what that's called on a graph. Lots of hills. Sometimes it's good, but I fear that for the most part it has been bad. Once Marston died, the writing of Wonder Woman was taken over by many different writers, all of whom had been men. And for the most part, I really do not believe that the men who were writing her actually liked her. What you said about Jill Lepore writing about Marston, that she doesn't like him. Well, these men, it seems like these men really have not liked Wonder Woman. At the very, very worst, she was completely disempowered by writer Jenny O'Neill in the late 60s. When the Amazons and Paradise Island simply disappeared and Wonder Woman lost her powers and stopped wearing her costume and was wearing a kind of an Emma Peels type white jumpsuit and had a mentor who was a little Chinese guy named I Ching. You know, Wonder Woman has a mentor. Plus, of course, it's so racist. I mean, a little Chinese guy named... Give me a break, I Ching. You know, what was he thinking?
There was some, I've forgotten the artist that somebody was commenting on the Wonder Woman page recently, who said he was asked the question about why he made changes to Wonder Woman. This was somebody who did this recently, and he said, it wasn't that I didn't like the character, I just didn't like her world. Okay.
In other words, he didn't like an island of strong women.
Yes. I think that would be the case. So I think what Trina said is pretty close to the truth. I think that one of the things that's happened, not only with men writing who didn't seem to like the character, but also the whole sort of corporate mentality, what's going to sell in this particular period. So the whole Emma Peel thing that happened during a particular period where that was really popular. So I think that probably also affects things, is that corporate, what's going to sell idea. maybe. You know, I'm just not too comfortable because I know the family, or at least, you know, I know one side of the family really well, and I know Christy really well. She's a close friend of mine. You know, I feel a little uncomfortable about ever speaking for the family or for them, because I don't want anybody speaking for my family or my grandfather. So, you know, it's hard to say, since there has been no really official family book. And by the way, what Pete and Christy told me when I saw them, that was a couple of years ago, They were excited when Jill Lepore came to them, because she does have such a good reputation, and she's a wonderful writer, and she's a very intelligent, smart woman. And they were under the impression that she was really going to approach this and do a great job, and they were very disappointed at how it came out. And, you know, for instance, Christy and I talked about this a lot. In Lepore's book, there's a picture of William Marston's mother and his aunts. You know the picture I'm talking about,
yes.
Where
And in Lepore's book, she says, she talks about these women, and she says something to the effect of, and these women were gliding across the floor, you know, like some gothic novel. And she speaks of his mother and his aunts as if they were repressed and didn't go anywhere. And when I talked to Christy about this, and she shared family stories with me, that was completely the opposite. These women were out in the world, again, at a period when a lot of women did not, they were, you know, were not out in the world. Marston's grandfather encouraged his daughters to get out into the world. So obviously, as a child growing up with aunts and a mother who were very strong and doing all kinds of interesting things, he was influenced by that. Obviously.
I think if she would ever be willing to do this, the person to write the biography of the family would be Christy Marston.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
One of the things that's interesting about Wonder Woman, too, is that it sometimes it seems like the history of the Marston family overshadows the character,
yeah.
Right? To the point where people spend so much time thinking about the dynamics of that family that they forget what's actually on the page, right?
That's why I wanted to show the politics, because, you know, the whole, you know, polyamorism and the bondage, you know, this has been so picked up, and it's been picked up by the boys. You know, excuse me, all you guys in the audience. I don't mean all of you, but this is, oh, wow. There he was, sleeping with two women, and oh, boy, bondage. And the guys love this. So, you know, they can't keep their hands off it. And so it's like, well, what I called it here a smokescreen. You know, you don't see all the rest. You don't see, for instance, Harry Peter's wonderful art. You don't see the politics. You don't see the Greek mythology.
And also, you know, you don't see the Marston family.
Yeah.
You don't see them as what appears to be the way they were. I mean, the first time I ever met Pete and Christy, they treated me like family. And that's the impression that I've gotten, interestingly, from Lepore's book. If you read it and read what she says about the family and forget her prejudice, what she presents is a very open, loving, caring family. And that certainly, I know you probably feel the same way with Pete and Christy, is that just...
Oh, Pete was a dear. He was such a dear.
Yeah, a really wonderful, wonderful, warm person. And so I think that a lot of this obscures what a lovely family. In Lepore's book, Shelley Mayer, and said, and he said, he said, this is a great family. You go, it's wonderful. Everybody's, you know, happy. The kids are all happy. Everybody's getting along. There's a great sense of, you know, openness. And I just think that these people were very unusual for their time. They were, they cared about women's suffrage, and they tried to walk their talk. And, you know, we're all just people, and we have our ideals, and sometimes those ideals don't match our humanity. But wow, what a great ideal to have, and thank you for this incredible character.
Quick note on the book. I feel, admittedly as man, it made me appreciate the family, and I didn't view them as freakish or anything bad. I mean, I think that book made me appreciate everything they that they did, and they worked through and they created. And I wonder, is there ever a thought that the book had a positive effect, or that there are folks who view them as positive after the LaPorte book?
Crickets.
I mean, we could do an informal poll, like, who here has a positive feeling of the Marston family after reading LaPorte's book? One half?
I think I did come away with that, even though I was prejudiced to begin with. So, and, you know, in spite of the way LaPorte phrased a lot of things, that is exactly what I came away with, is a really strong sense of a wonderful family. Yeah. So, you know.
Yeah, quick follow-up, maybe more on topic. For Trina, are there other characters that like, this is a new character for me, are there other characters that you also see embodied a lot of the ideals that Wonder Woman had at this time, strong female characters of the dead?
There have been, since then, some very strong superheroines, if that's what you're talking about. Actually, Miss Fury made her debut before Wonder Woman, 6 months before Wonder Woman, and she was written and drawn by a woman, Tarpe Mills. She's very different from Wonder Woman. There's no mythology in there, except a little bit of mysticism around her costume, which was supposed to have belonged to an African witch doctor before she wore it. But it's a great read. It's very film noir. You know, the period is throughout the 40s, and it's really like all those wonderful film noir movies, and the heroine is certainly extremely strong, but it's just different.
There is a character that appeared in my grandfather's early comics, which most people have just simply not seen. And she was called Sandra of the Secret Service.
Oh, I love that.
And my grandfather wrote the scripts for those. And he grew up in a household with a very strong woman in his mother. And so he was obviously very influenced by that as well.
Yeah, when Wonder Woman was being, you know, introduced, she was an extremely popular comic book with these moral, social tales. Do we think that is even a possibility today in the comic, the way the comics are written today, and in that kind of serial form, that you could tell these moral tales, these political, social stories, as opposed to bang them up, shoot them up, and have her be a popular character being true to that initial idea?
I think that mainstream comics tend to be very politically conservative. I don't mean reactionary, I don't mean right-wing, but just conservative in that they're very careful about anything they say that might have social relevance. And I think this is why in mainstream comics the superheroes are always just fighting some kind of weird supervillain who's not even really human or who's an alien or something. You know, they don't want to deal with contemporary politics. I think that you'll find much more socially relevant stories in the independent graphic novels written by men and women, you know, created by men and women.
And there's such an incredible
outflowing
in that area. So be sure you go roam the aisles of the small press and the artist alley. I mean, it's really encouraging and exciting.
That's the woman in the red t-shirt. She's had her hand.
So you were mentioning about the LaPorte's book, how I haven't read it, full disclosure. I actually had a different conception of what this panel was going to be. But I actually did. This is fantastic. This is better than I thought it was going to be. Sorry, that's not... Anyway, I'll stop. Anyway, so what I'm saying is, do you think LaPorte, having gotten your perspective of the book, do you think LaPorte was... Because it sounds to me that she was almost so insistent that because it was the 40s and 50s and 60s, that these women had to be oppressed,
know the poor, so I don't know why she did that. I think, as a writer myself, you know, you get an idea in your head about something, and you, you know, go for it, you pursue it. And I think she just got some kind of idea in her head about promoting Margaret Sanger, which is admirable. I mean, let's promote Margaret Sanger, yay. But, you know, that she got lost, I think, then. It wasn't really about Wonder Woman. It was more about the poor's point of view about Margaret Sanger and the suffrage movement, which, you know, my great-grandmother was a suffragette. So, yeah, I love that. I'm interested in it. But the book was misleading, I think. And I think she just got lost in the woods there. One of my friends went to one of her talks and said that she comes right out and says, I don't know anything about comic book history. And so that's the end of that.
She has a very low opinion about comics. She said quite a few times she's been very dismissive of comics.
You know, what is she doing writing a book about comics? you know, I don't know if you guys have read Larry Tye's wonderful book on Superman. It's a terrific book. And Larry, who is a journalist and not a comics person, my gosh, that man was amazing in his research. He just did impeccable, careful, thoughtful research. He went for it. So you don't have to be a comics person or historian to write a book about comics, but you do have to have respect for them, in my opinion. Or Athena.
Yeah. So I'm curious, like what you were saying about the superhero comics, you know, largely, and movies largely having these, you know, magical villains. And, you know, do you feel like the goddesses are essential to Wonder Woman's character?
Oh my gosh.
Yes.
Yeah.
The goddesses, to a certain degree, are her other parent in mythology. The hero, the mythic hero, usually is a product of a virginal mother human and a god. In the case of Wonder Woman, the virginal mother is Hippolyta, and Aphrodite actually breathes the breath of life into the little statue that Hippolyta has created of clay, which is like the Pygmalion story. But this makes her other parent a female, Aphrodite.
And you know what else is interesting about that? Is that the Superman comes from another planet to Earth. Wonder Woman comes out of the Earth itself.
Yes, she's created from the Earth.
Right, right.
Ooh, she really wants to. I think that I must have been about 10 when I started reading Wonder Woman. And to start with, the comic taught me about Amazons. I hadn't known anything about Amazons. Kids nowadays know lots about Amazons because of Wonder Woman. You know, and when I later in life, you know, well, still young, but discovering Greek mythology, I found Amazons. But at 10, I had never known about Amazons before. And whoa! Wow! An island of beautiful warrior women, and no men are allowed? How cool is that, you know?
Well, for me, I grew up in Mobile, Alabama, in the early 50s. And my grandmother, my maternal grandmother, used to take us to, this is classic, to the local drugstore. And we would sit on the, I'm giving away all day, we would sit on the stools and get cherry cokes, and there were the spinning racks, and I always went for anything that had a female character. I just
me too. You know that.
Yes. You know, and I just loved Wonder Woman, and I think that's one of the things that I ended up doing a master's in Greek mythology, the divine feminine aspects. And I've been crazy about Amazons from the very beginning, so that's how I got started.
Purple? Yeah.
Can we go back to one of the images that was up there before of Wonder Woman? And she's standing alone, and I just wanted another look at the proportions on that drawing, because it struck me that the head and the feet were very small, and the section of her in the middle was...
Was it the Harry Peter image? I mean, not like these all...
No, they're all Harry Peter images.
I was just wondering when it was done, that was put into a historical context.
I
think it's the one you showed, the one of the earliest sketches he did with the skirt.
Yeah. That one?
Yeah.
It just struck me that the proportions on that drawing I find unsettling.
Oh, well, I think it's...
The head's small, the head's small, the hips are very broad, and our perception of beauty today, feminine beauty, skinny, you know, many women are shapeless. Obviously, she is not shapeless. I just want to know when this was done.
41.
41?
Mm-hmm. 41. The minute I saw that, I just immediately thought Amazon. Yep. You know, because that is a strong, strong body. And, you know, if you see the Amazons on the vase paintings and some of the statues, that's also, you know, very much the mythology that was passed down. Hippolyta is, you know, that's right out of the Greek myths, and there's some historical possibilities that these women warriors existed. There's a wonderful site on Amazons that a lot of people contribute to.
They have uncovered, archaeologists have uncovered evidence of women warriors in many different ancient cultures.
Right. If you're really interested in the academic side of it, and you might want to check out Mariha Gimbutas.
Oh, yeah.
She was an academic, an archaeologist, anthropologist, working in the field. Joseph Campbell quotes her quite a bit. That's how I discovered her. And she's really amazing. So if that's something that interests you, you might want to check her out.
All right, probably last question, Vision.
Can you talk about some of the social relevance that actually happened at the time when people saw the images, like with doing things for better working conditions or things like milk prices and stuff? Can you talk about that impact?
Wouldn't it be wonderful if Wonder Woman could influence things like milk prices and better working conditions? I don't think she had that much influence. But if anything, the girls and some boys who read these comics might have certainly, you know, grown up with fairer ideas about labor and about unions and about politics in general. You know, I think she opened young minds.
Okay, we have time for one more question, but only if it's short. Yeah, go for it.
What is your favorite Wonder Woman image? Like, what period of time is your favorite?
Oh, the Golden Age, of course. Yeah. I mean, as created by Harry G. Peter, the Golden Age Wonder Woman is the Wonder Woman. And he's very underappreciated. But, you know, if you really think of it, he is half of the creation of Wonder Woman.
Right.
I mean, Marston wrote her, but
the reason she looks the way she does, and she is iconic, you know, is because Harry G. Peter drew her that way. And, you know, this is another thing about the guys, the artists who get hold of her, the male artists, and who don't really like her. They always want to change her costume. Her costume is always being changed. It's like these guys can't get their hands off her costume. Oh boy, I can draw her, I'll change her costume. But it always goes back to some version of the iconic costume. Even, you know, in the movie, she is wearing the iconic costume.
I really like this version of the costume too, because it really speaks to the warrior woman.
Well, and this is close to the movie.
Yeah. And I thought that was one thing in the movie that was terrific, because that costume really...
But it is a variation of the iconic costume.
Right.
I mean, it's not her in Doc Martens and whatever, you know. Guys like to stick, you know.
All right, well, unfortunately, we are out of time. I'd like to thank our presenters.